You're listening to History Out Loud, Chat from the Stacks, a podcast by Calderdale Libraries. Presented by Jill Carpenter. I'm really pleased to be joined today on History Out Loud by cartographer and author Christopher Goddard. You live locally, don't you, Chris?
Yeah, that's right. I live in Hebden Bridge.
First of all, I want to say that I'm a real map fan. I'm really into maps. Get it from my mum. We get maps off the shelf at a drop of a hat. And this is something I'm really interested in. Is there a word for someone who really loves maps? Is there an official word or just map lover?
Oh, I feel like there should be, but I can't think of it offhand. Something to do with Latin, but yeah, cartophile should, you know.
Yeah, cartophile. That sounds good. Yeah. I could see your wall behind you is just covered in maps.
Yeah, well, it took me a long time to do that because I've actually pasted them onto the wall. But
oh, have you?
I realised, yeah, which seems anathema because it means I can't use them anymore. But I had so many maps and I realised that I was never going to use, you know, a map of the Antarctica and like old maps of parts of France. So I had a load of maps that I just put up there. But obviously, I've always been a huge fan of maps. Since I was a kid, yes, my parents too.
Yeah. You've been making maps for a very long time, haven't you? How did it begin? Can you remember your first map?
Probably not, but I have got like a folder here of maps I drew as a kid. I didn't have the ages and dates on them, but there's some quite naive maps of my like local wood, you know, that we would go and build dens in, and me and my brother, and we'd give names to like features of an old quarry, and we called it Ngorongoro after because we'd seen a documentary about the crater in Tanzania. So I've sort of made maps of those with all these little names on, and I look back at them and I'm like, they're really good. I wish I could make as creative a map with made-up names now. I'm making very different maps. But, I made maps of, like, bike paths in the forest on the other side of the house. When we go on holiday, I remember making maps in Greece that look more like the ones that I do now, probably as a teenager, and sort of quite intricate maps of the coastline there, like pencil-drawn, that look quite familiar.
You said that you found, when you went to Greece, that the maps that were available were quite disappointing. Is that what spurred you on?
Probably. I mean, would I have done it anyway? Possibly. But yeah, I suddenly realised that there weren't OS maps everywhere else. And I mean, we'd just been in France last week and the maps that I was using there were not good enough. And I just had to resist the temptation to spend the whole time trying to draw my own versions. But it's still true that, you know, we're fortunate with the detail of mapping that we have here compared to other places.
You were born in Sheffield and you grew up in a place called Outbridge. So,
Outbridge.
Oh, sorry.
No one can pronounce it.
Outbridge.
Yeah.
Was that a good place for a cartographer to start life?
I mean, I would say yes. I think it could be anywhere. I mean, I like to think now that there's interesting stuff on your doorstep wherever you are. But it was great because there were little woods either side of where the house was in a small estate. So, we'd just go off, especially like some holidays, just building dens, you know, cycling, running, kind of playing in the woods and sort of having this whole kind of world that we created that felt like ours. And anytime anyone else came through, we resented it. Would sit there, hide there in the dens, sort of, playing, you know, probably playing war games or something. But yeah, it was great for that, for being outdoors a lot, even though it's on the edge of a city. You know, there's a lot around the edge of Sheffield, which is quite rural, and felt safe to be out and about.
It sounds quite familiar to me. Dens was very much part of my childhood, and I just don't know where the kids make. Do they still make dens? I don't know.
You see some in the woods, but they look kind of too well built. I think parents build the dens with the kids now. I think they probably got harking back to their own childhood.
Yes, maybe. But getting involved when they're not needed. Your mum said that you were born a good century too late in terms of your love of maps. Is there an expedition from history you would, given your right arm to be on? Well, maybe not your right arm, but if you're right-handed.
Yeah, you probably would have had to have given it because it would have lost, you know, the dangers associated with it. It all seems very sort of romantic to me, the idea of exploring parts of the world uncharted. But actually, if you'd been there, I mean, it would have probably been terrifying and, yeah, risking life and limb compared to the things I do now. I can't think of anything particular. I mean,
You said you had maps of Antarctica. Was that anything that you used to fantasise about?
Not particularly Antarctica. Mountains were the thing that I think I would be drawn to. I've always, like, I can look at contours and see the layout of the land. I'm always surprised when other people can't do that. But you can see a map of a mountain range, and I can picture the ridge and the peak and kind of immediately want to be there and looking out over the others and thinking what I would be seeing from there. And I, you know, on the beach, as other kids made sandcastles, I made mountain ranges that kind of matched, you know, these things in my mind, and imaginary mountain ranges and ridges and like routes up them. I wasn't into mountaineering. It was just a love of like the kind of the beauty of the world and being on top of it. Climb mountains whenever I can, but nothing too technical.
It's like being able to read a different language in a way, isn't it? Is this something that came very naturally to you, to be able to look at contours and then just envisage the actual mountain in front of you?
I think it must be natural, because I don't remember ever learning it, and we were around maps. My mum always had maps of everywhere we went, and so I became very familiar with them. But I don't think my parents didn't teach me. It was quite obvious quite early when we go walking that I could read the map better than them. My dad, you know, loved going out and walking the mountains, very quickly followed wherever I suggested. I remember one walk with a bunch of friends or similar-aged people to him, you know, middle-aged people, and we got in the mist in the Welsh mountains, and I said it was this way, and they all said it was that way, and they ended up splitting up. They said, well, they know, well, they're not going to follow the kid. Well, they were up in the mountains for hours, and me and my dad were home back on the campsite waiting for them. And so I guess it must have just been sort of instinctive, and that's sort of why I'm drawn to maps and drawn to making them, I suppose.
Your dad obviously knew that you had the talents. Yeah. You say you're desperate not to miss anything. Do you think this is at the core of what you do, or are there other things as well that you think are fueling this?
What do you mean by fueling this?
Your sort of desire to map things. You know, like when you said you were away and the maps weren't good enough and you had to restrain yourself a bit from creating one.
It's kind of how I see the world, I suppose. Sort of immediately take myself above it and imagine a map of it and see how things interrelate. I always kind of want to do that. And I guess I don't know whether I ever thought like I would do it so other people could follow it. I think I was doing maps for myself as much as anything else, just to record where I'd been, but also sort of make sense. But when I look at these maps I did at, you know, at like age 12 or 13, I've got a route around that we did in the Welsh mountains with peaks and then route directions. And it's like, yeah, maybe that was what I always wanted. I didn't necessarily know that I wanted to be a guidebook writer, but perhaps that was always there.
You left Sheffield eventually and you went to study at Cambridge. What did you study there? Was it relating to maps?
it was geography, naturally, which had always been my subject at school. Yeah, I just was passionate about, and it kind of opened up new ideas and new kind of ways of thinking of the world. But I found Cambridge, which we talk about anywhere being interesting with maps, I found Cambridge incredibly difficult because it was so flat to get to grips with. I'm used to the Yorkshire landscape, you climb the hill and you look down and you can make sense of like the topography and the way that things relate, and you can't do that there. And I never felt like quite settled, and kind of felt I always wanted to move back west or north, or you know, somewhere hillier.
Yeah, and I know what you mean. I once got lost in a wood that was completely flat. I think because I was used to woods around here, I always thought, well, you always find your way out and around and about.
You do feel a little bit powerless, and especially in that sort of wood, which, yes, looks the same everywhere you turn. It's no wonder so many sort of like, yeah, magical stories are about that landscape.
That's true, actually, yeah. You got a job as a rights of way and national trail surveyor.
Yeah, I was looking for work as a ranger or whatever I could get, and somehow fluked kind of my perfect job working for the Lake District National Park Authority as a footpath surveyor, walking all of their public rights of way and recording what was on them. And I kind of couldn't believe that this was a job. You know, I was walking up mountains, you know, doing exactly what I wanted to do in my spare time, and I was getting paid for it. And that was only a short, you know, an 18-month job. But after that, I've ended up doing pretty much the same thing, freelance around the country, doing surveys for local councils. Not normally in as nice a place as the Lake District, but there's very few of them that I haven't enjoyed. It's really good exploring in depth the parts of the country that I wouldn't otherwise have gone to.
Do they just pay for you to stay there, do you work and then come home, or...?
Yeah, I mean, I just get paid a flat rate for walking, which suits me because I could walk pretty quickly. And yeah, I take my camper van or various iterations of camper vans and, yeah, work there for a few weeks, come home. Yeah, there's less of that work now. That was all started under the sort of Labour years. There was a bit more money in the public sector for that sort of work. But it meant that I also had kind of about half the year I'd be working and half the year I wouldn't, because it's quite intense sort of work. So that's why I started doing the books, because I had enough spare time from that work to be able to put into writing what was, you know, the West Yorkshire Moors.
That sounds just like perfect setup, really, that you work for a period of time and then you get to do the thing you're really passionate about. So eventually, in 2006, you and your partner moved to Hebden Bridge, didn't you?
Yeah, we were both freelance, so we could have gone anywhere. And we'd sort of been moving around on the road. We'd been in the Lake District, lived in Wales briefly, but I kind of wanted to come back to Yorkshire. She didn't particularly want to, but she's come to love it. But I'd been through Hebden Bridge a couple of times when I was younger. I mean, I was in the Scouts. I was on a Scout event that came through Hebden Bridge in the middle of the night. And I remember thinking then, this is lovely. I could totally live here, you know, I never wanted to live in cities. And I was like, this is just such a beautiful place. So I think that stuck. And I'd been back and been to the trades club at some point in the subsequent years. So moved here and, yeah. And I've ended up buying a house, which I never thought I'd do. I always thought I'd move around all the time. And it feels as much like home as anywhere has ever been to me.
So you say that when you moved here, one of the first things you did was just go up on the tops just to work out where you fitted in, you know, into the landscape. It's quite a beautiful, complex landscape of interlocking valleys, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, as I said earlier, that's kind of the first thing I would do anywhere, really. But I would moved into the house. I'm allergic to cats. We'd been struggling to find somewhere that we could have, you know, have a dog. So I'd quickly taken this place after being in it for 5 minutes and obviously not noticed that there'd been four cats in there. And I couldn't breathe. I couldn't stay in the house. Oh, it was winter and I was just sleeping in the camper van. And all day I couldn't be in the house. So I just was out walking. It was fortunate. It was really nice weather. So, one day I'd go on to, Midgley Moor and Wadsworth Moor. The next day I'd go up on Studley, and I got, you know, within that first sort of week, I'd sort of felt I'd got to know the area and had a real sense of just how special this landscape was that we moved into.
You say that you found that the OS maps were quite disappointing with regards to the moors. What were the problems there?
Well, there's a couple of places where you can go up onto the moors and you get used to following the green on the 1 to 25,000 map, the green dashed lines that mark public rights of way. And you're like, well, there's going to be a path there most of the time. And you get up on the moors and there isn't paths where the green dots are, but there are loads of other paths. And it was particularly true around Dimmindale, up on Wadsworth Moor. There's a load of theoretical public rights of way, and they're not the same as the paths. And actually, it's true over Midgley Moor as well. And I started to think about, there's something here that would help people. And I can't remember whether it was like that the next day or two, or maybe the next time I went back onto that moor, sort of took paper and started to note down stuff and draw a map. And I didn't think at that point it was going to be a book. I just wanted to sort of make sense of it for myself at that point.
Do you think footpaths across moors are ever changing because of the weather, like the coming and going of bogs? Or do you think that the OS people just didn't really have a handle on it?
Ooh.
I know you don't want to diss the OS people. But
the old routes, I mean, what you'd actually find is, I later did a survey of Calderdale after we moved here. Fortunately, got paid to do a survey of all the paths for Calderdale. And so then you are following the legal paths. And you would find actually that there was a groove, in the grass or the heather, and it's like, like slight sunken hollowway where you thought there's no path here. It's, you wouldn't want to follow it because it's almost even deeper heather when you're in those grooves, but there would be something there. So obviously there was an old route, but it's got grown over and people have found a new line.
Mm.
What people wanted to do on the moors has changed. It used to be they were just a place to be got over and got from one valley to the next or one village to another. Whereas now we want to climb up to the top of the hill. We want to go and seek out things. We want to follow the nice edge. We're looking for sort of leisure routes.
Yeah.
So we've created a whole series of new paths that have nothing to do with this, these historical routes. And even things like that, an old boundary stone would have like a marker of that was just a boundary marker. Then they would go and beat the bounds. So once a year they'd follow a line around these, but there wouldn't have been a path there because you wouldn't necessarily want to be following the boundary. They were just a line of stones. Now the path will form to those stones, maybe along the line of them, because people are interested in those as historic sites when they were previously just functional items. It was until the Victorians, and we weren't really that interested in our sort of ancient history, but particularly, and maybe we knew some sites like the Miller's Grave, maybe it had a reputation, but people didn't necessarily want to visit it or want to research its history. Since the Victorians have become increasingly kind of our focus, and suddenly those are the sites we want to go to. And there's a lot of interesting features to find on the moors that are preserved there because the landscapes have never been farmed.
So this has all led to your first book, The West Yorkshire Moors, which was published in 2013. How long did it take to write that? It seems like quite a massive project, really.
So I've often said it took 8 years, but if it came out in 2013, it must have been, it was like 7 years because we only moved here in 2006. So yeah, but all that time basically from moving here until 2013. But it started slowly because I was doing maps. And at first I'd thought of a book, which was, because I had all these Wainwright maps of the Lake District Mountains and then maps of the like peaks in North Wales. I'd been doing a survey around Kirklees as well. I'd been up on the top of the Pennines there, and all of these peaks, the high points were sort of morasses of just flat ground. So I thought at first, I was like, oh, I could do a like the worst, book of like the worst peaks in the country. It was kind of tongue in cheek. And I remember doing a map of Waystone Edge for that, which is actually the highest point in Calderdale, is above the M62. There's a nice edge, and then there's just a big flat wasteland. Somewhere in the middle of that, one little lump of tussock and peat is slightly higher than the others. But the more I kind of actually, I don't know how serious I was about that, but the more I sort of went to these places and started mapping them and then researching like from old maps of these historical sites, I realized just how much was there and that was underselling, that actually these are really beautiful places. And part of the kind of appeal is that you get up there, it's flat, and you're kind of lost in a completely different world. You don't see any of the valleys. And just, yeah, a couple of miles out of quite a populated area, you could be lost in a landscape, especially if it's in mist, and feel like you are in the middle of nowhere now. So, yeah, from sort of almost taking the mick, I've ended up singing the praises of these moors.
Was it Ted Hughes said something about the moors that was... Oh, I wish I could remember it now. Oh, well.
Is it the moors or a stage set for the...
Yes, that's the one, yeah.
Got it in here. In the second edition, because the first one, we were worried about permissions. And yeah, Hughes said moors are a stage for the performance of heaven. Any audience is incidental.
That's beautiful.
And there was this weird thing that I would be out exploring these moors for, well, years, but, you know, and I never saw people really. You know, maybe at weekends occasionally, but most of the time I was on my own, just me and the dog. And yet I would start talking to people that I was doing a book on it in the pub, and they say, oh, I love that. I love this place. I love, you know, I always go there, and I'm like, why don't I see you? You know, and why are all these paths here? There's, yeah. Most people have been up on the moors and go out semi-regularly, and yet they seem to sort of swallow you up and leave you on your own, which I think is exactly kind of what you want when you go there.
Yes, yes. When the book was published, you were quite surprised by the response, weren't you? It was extremely popular, almost from the word go.
Yeah, I'd got a publisher. It's the only book I've had a publisher for in Huddersfield, and they really liked it, which was promising. I think they did 50 copies. And I, you know, so excited to finally have my own book, and I've got it here. This is one of those 50. This doesn't even have its cover because it's come off. But I took a bag full of them to like a friend's party because I knew people there, and I thought I'll just see if people are interested in it. And sort of slightly felt I usurped the party because suddenly they were passing around everyone, and everyone was saying such nice things. They couldn't believe I'd done this book. And it was such a kind of rush of like, oh, wow, all this effort is worth it. This is a thing. And almost, having said I was never going to do one again, almost after that night, I started on the next book because I was just like, wow, people like it. That's brilliant. I was so chuffed.
People liked the sketches, didn't they? But you don't think of yourself, or you didn't think of yourself as an artist. Did you just start drawing to illustrate your maps, or has that always been part of your life?
I've been interested in art. I used to try and do some, but I was not very talented. I could never draw anybody's face. I could never very accurate. I was much more interested in sort of surreal things and collages. But that first book, I did realise it needed something to balance it out. Sketches made sense. And at one point I was talking to another artist about maybe doing my sketches for me. And then we talked about like money, and it's like, I'm going to give up half the book, basically the money from the book. And I was like, well, I've done so much work on this. I can't do that. So I started to sketch, and I thought they were terrible. And some of the first ones are, I mean, you can tell, I can tell like Chernmill Joan, but I got better. And I think over the books, I think I've got better. And I also know what I'm good at drawing and which angles. I'm still not great at necessarily three dimension or drawing people's faces. That's why my picture of me is from the side. But if you look at the first version of the first book, there were some photos in of the overall moors. Each individual moor had a photo on the frontispiece page. By the second, when I redid it 5 years later, I redid those as sketches, and they were so much better. And it just had no confidence at the beginning that I could do that. And thus, you know, the picture on the front of the first one was quite basic, and I was really happy with the picture that's on the second edition. So yeah, it's something I've sort of forced myself to do to the point where I think it's okay. But yeah, people seem to like it, so I'm very happy.
It's more than okay. They're brilliant. It's the attention to detail as well. Even when you're not drawing sketches, you'll mark a lone tree. And this sort of thing, I think, just draws people in. You say you avoided looking at Wainwright.
I'd inherited from my grandpa, you know, all of the Wainwright books. And I've used them a bit, but I'd read through them at home, and I was obviously influenced by them. I'd seen them a lot, but they're not for probably 5 years before doing this book, really, would I like particularly looked at them. Martin Richards did a series of guides on the Peak District in a sort of similar style. He'd actually studied under Wainwright and been taught to sketch, you know, like him. And I'd, you know, my school prize, I remember for my geography prize, I got those books. So both of those influenced me. But I didn't look at those either. I was very keen to try and come up with my own style. Obviously, you compare because they're hand-drawn, but once mine had been published, I looked at Wainwright. I was like, oh, that's not what I remembered. They're quite sparse in places. As he's got contours on, it looks full. But actually, if you look at sort of the density of the things that I've mapped on mine, I was like, they're like crazy detail and all the tiny little paths that I've marked. Yeah, I was like, oh, I've gone further in a way. He was more of a sort of, not artist, but it was the way he portrayed it. The sketches are very detailed and large scale, and then the maps from the side on where you could sort of see the way up the mountains. Almost less of a cartographer, more, I can't think of the word, but they are different things, and I'm very happy that I did it that way.
The way that you sort of section together all the different points, you know, where you might say mention something like Hebble Hole, and then above it there's the picture of the Clapper Bridge, and just the way it all fits, it must have taken quite a while to kind of structure them.
Yeah, you know, I guess that's the artistic part of trying to make a page which looks like you could put it on the wall, I think.
Yeah.
And it's quite uniquely put together for a book. You know, the publisher was like, oh, have you got the text? I was like, no, it's in a series of layers in Photoshop layered around them. You know, so no one could do a spell check. If normally you'd write the text, you'd draw a map, and you'd do the sketches, and you'd send it to a publisher to put together the layout. And there's no way I wanted anybody else to have any control over that, mess it up. When you send it to a printer or a publisher, it's going to come back looking the same because it's basically just an image. Which is sort of the way I see it, I suppose.
And people do buy your maps to actually frame and put on the wall, don't they?
Yes, I do have prints, and I'm really happy about that.
After West Yorkshire Moors, the other books followed. You did one on the Wales Coastal Path.
That book is different because it's just a sort of pictorial, like photo based colour guide to walking a long distance route around the coast of Wales. So it doesn't have the detail that my maps do, and it was one directly taken from a job. We were paid to do it, and I managed to make a book out of it. But
So the Wales Coastal Path book was it was a bit of a departure from what you were doing before then. But then you went on to West Yorkshire Woods Part 1 and 2, and the two volumes is because you quickly realised that there were too many woods in the county for a single volume, which is, it's a lovely thing, that, really, isn't it? Wow, there's just too many woods. It needs two books.
But three, because...
Oh, it's a three now.
Well, I haven't started on part three, but anyone who lives in Kirklees and Wakefield will know that I haven't covered that side of the county, so that will be book three. But yeah, it's the detail and the sort of the fact that woods are so dense. Moors are big open spaces. I mean, obviously there's more, as I've said, there's far more there than when it first meets the eye, but you've still got emptiness. The woods are just this dense mass of like little paths, you know, different trees, often on steep hillsides. It's so to portray them, I had to sort of almost zoom in more, if that was possible. And though I should say, if I did it again, I would have done the moors in two parts.
Would you?
Now, looking back, yeah. I missed out a couple of little bits like Norland Moor and Bailden Moor. And the book is bigger than the other books. And there was a couple of corners I would have liked to have been a bit more detailed on. I think, yeah, knowing what I do now, I would have probably spread it over two books. But yeah, it's done.
The woods are amazing, really. I mean, I've lived here a long time, but I've got so many paths. And there's some that, I don't know whether you will know, the ones at the bottom of Eve's Wood, which are, they're just kind of like really strange steps that interlock and go up. And
they were Victorian. I think it was just for leisure.
Yeah.
And they had a very romantic idea of paths. So they're not straight. They're not functional, are they? They weave. And yeah, it seems like there's too many in one small bit. But
it does.
Yeah. But they are fascinating, yeah, and I don't know any others quite like them. But it's strange because if you look at that wood on a lot of photos from the turn of the 20th century, those trees were very thin. There were still woods there, but they were really suffered because of the industrial pollution. And if it would have been very different from what we've got now, it would have been very thin, and you probably would have had more views out from it.
I think they planted a lot of beech trees, didn't they, as well?
Yeah, there's...
At the bottom.
Yeah, in that wood. Across Calderdale, there's a significant number of beech and sycamore plantations from the same period, sort of mid to late 19th century. They clear-felled areas of... Presumably would have been, you know, the trees we naturally have, oak and birch.
Mm.
And replace them with what they thought would have been quicker growing. Like there were plantations they wanted to use because they needed various things for the mills. Wood was used quite a lot. So they replanted them because they wanted the wood, but they never got to maturity. They didn't grow particularly well on the hills because they were steep hillsides. Beech is not particularly natural to this sort of latitude. Sycamore goes everywhere, but yeah, so they just got left, and we now have this sort of strange, sort of great mature beech woods with nothing underneath. It's sort of leftover from that era. And what was interesting going into the Air Valley book, I thought the Air Valley is only, you know, 5 to 10 miles away. It's not far over the hill, and you'd kind of think it would be the same patterns repeated there because most of the same forces were at work. But they didn't plant those trees. You don't get beech and sycamore plantations in the same way as you do in the Calder Valley. And I don't know why that was, but it's very interesting. That's just a particular local kind of feature.
Yeah, they're quite majestic, aren't they? And the squirrels like them.
Yeah, Alfie, the dog, loves them, yeah.
Yeah.
In the woods, you can't see anything, so you have to go and explore it all. You're relying entirely on what you see, which is kind of how you probably should map. But
it's interesting that you can't see from above what's going on in woods, and I think that makes them the magical places they are as well, doesn't it? And the things you discover sometimes are completely individual that other people might not notice. And
absolutely, yeah, I think that's exactly why we kind of love them, and they change so much as well in the seasons. And you know, the things you will see in the winter, you'll see a lot more ground features. You'll see like flattened areas where charcoal was burned or old trackways. In the summer, the dense foliage, you suddenly notice the trees, you notice other things. You notice like a mossy rock, but suddenly the green is jumping out at you.
Mm.
Yeah, I love that about it, that they change with the seas. Just in the last week, we've had this change into autumn. You can just feel it coming. And I sort of, I don't know, got a little bit bored of the wood that I walked the dog in over the summer because it's darker, the foliage is in full bloom, and just those changes into suddenly a few leaves dropping, slightly different hues. There was some mist the other morning, and I was like, oh, I love this. I've missed, you know, and a bit colder in the air. I think I love the seasons, and a lot of what we think of the seasons is actually the woods themselves, really.
It's true. You're getting a lot of the mushrooms and toadstools coming up now as well. Just suddenly they just come from nowhere. You walk along this path every day and then there's Fly Garrick just kind of there. It's really amazing transformations overnight.
It is the strange thing about mapping woods, because one of the best things possibly about woods are seeing wildlife or finding some mushrooms, or maybe the distinctive tree, maybe a shape of a tree branch, and you're like, you take a particular interest in that. You can't map these things. They're so personal. I mean, obviously, they change some of those. So it's quite hard to map in the sense that it's not permanent, whereas a lot more of the things on the moor are much more permanent. It's like a rock is a feature that stays, and you like to go to that rock because it's an interesting shape or good viewpoint. But yeah, the woods are constantly shifting and you can't pin them down.
You mentioned as well that updates is quite a thing for you, isn't it? Because the nature of maps is that everything is changing.
They are just a snapshot of what the world looked like at a particular point that I went there.
Yeah.
With maybe updates from if I go back again. There's a map in the Air Valley book where I'd mapped this sort of open quarry in a woodland area, and by the time I'd come back to check one of the routes at the end of the survey, there were some trees in there, they'd completely cleared it, and they were going to build a housing estate, which is probably there by now. And I was like, shall I change it? And they'd put up this big fence and it completely changed the feel of it. And then I thought, no, this is the snapshot that I did. And it'd be nice to have that sort of, this is what was there before the housing estate. And normally when I go back, I probably will change it. But I wanted the first edition to reflect that. But as a guidebook, you kind of do have to change it. You know, the first wind farms built since that first moorland book was produced. And I had, you know, suddenly there's big tracks across the moors above Todmorden. And it completely changed the landscape there as well. But you kind of have to put those on now to, otherwise you really struggle to use the map.
Have you had to learn how to draw turbines?
I don't think I've drawn any close-up yet, but I think I could manage that.
Yeah.
But at first I was like, oh, you've changed this landscape that I'd got to know. And I'd sort of fixed in a place on a map. And it's like, yeah, this is that moor. And then you go back and you're like, oh, no, it's something different now. They haven't ruined it. It's just, you know, quite like, especially when it's misty and you've just got the turbines and the swoosh, you know, you're lost in that world. I think, yeah, it's just different, and none of us like change, but you have to accept that. Yeah.
I wanted to talk a bit about your, I'm calling them special maps because they're individual maps, and one of them in particular, the Cragvale Coiner's Walk. So the Coiners, they were an 18th century criminal counterfeiting gang, weren't they? Led by someone called David Hartley, King David Hartley, as he was known as. How did you find out about the Coiners?
It feels like everybody knows the Coiners now. They've become such a big thing. But yeah, when I was researching the Moors book, I did a feature on them and probably should have done more. But they were particularly fascinating local story with sort of national significance, but I wouldn't have done obviously that walk as it was without Ben Meyer's book, you know, The Gallows Pole, which was just sort of taking off when the bookcase suggested that we did a collaboration and sort of pushed us together and shared our contact details, and both me and Ben were sort of unproactive but liked the idea, and we, you know, it was going for a walk and producing a map. And yeah, that was I hadn't thought of doing any separate maps at that time, but the opportunity to go out and have a walk with Ben and try and put together the places where the Coiners, you know, the significant locations for the Coiners, and also some locations from his book that relate to the events that he'd included, some of which are fictitious or based upon things that might have happened, but he, you know, he's used a degree of literary license in that book.
Yeah. So you didn't know Ben before?
No.
No. And did you kind of just meet in the pub and have a chat first? Or did you just get straight out there?
We had a chat and we're both, it's like really kind of laid back and it was like, yeah, this will work. And sort of agreed a premise. I suggested a route and he's like, yeah, that was, you know, and we just kind of tweaked it a little depending on whether we could take in any particular sites. It came together really quickly. And it was just, you know, a day's walk. And it kind of feels strange now because it was just a, oh, well, let's try this. It could work. And now, you know, they're having to do loads of work on the Moreland section. The crows are doing a lot of boardwalks and, you know, diverting the path because of the number of people using it. And it's quite it feels really strange to think of like where that started as quite a kind of low-key idea.
We should probably say who the crows are.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Just for anybody who doesn't know.
True. Calderdale Rights of Way Service.
Yeah.
An independent group of people who do an amazing amount of work, volunteer work on the footpath network around Upper Calder Valley. And, you know, the council is not in a position to do in very much these days. They haven't got the money. So crows are basically stepping in to do a lot of that work and keeping our footpaths open. What is now Erringdon Moor is kind of squeezed in. It's still a kind of blank and featureless place with bogs where you wouldn't expect to find them, exactly as sort of described in the book. But if you think of the area of like Walling just beyond towards Studley and the plantation, all of that was created after the coiners were active. Those are 19th century enclosures. So what it would have been a much bigger expanse that went all the way to Studley Pike, which of course wasn't there. So you've got a very different landscape now. You get a sense of it, but imagine it just being on the edge of the void, really, and a much larger area of complete boggy wilderness there. I get far more comments on that walk than any of the others now. It feels like most of my routes are, I try and devise like off the beaten path routes, like that take in little paths you wouldn't normally use or go to sites maybe not used and perhaps have a bit of pathless stuff. So they're a little bit more challenging than most walking routes, I think. I've toned it down a bit because people have had trouble with some of the ones in the first book, but I try and not produce a walk that anyone would ever have put in a walking book before. But it feels like with the Coiner's Walk, it's quite a normal sort of walk with just a few sites taken in. By my standards, it's not very adventurous. It's just, it's got an interesting link with history. And it's a lot shorter than a lot of the others. So it's strange, yeah. I guess it's natural that one should be the most popular. But
I mean, I imagine when the Gallows Pole TV series eventually comes out, your map's going to be even more popular.
Yes, I'm sure it will, and I'm sure that's why they're doing a lot of work on it now, because they know, yeah, it'll be very interesting to see.
What plans do you have for the future? Have you got any mapping expeditions you'd like to undertake?
Yeah, so I'm naturally sort of having to move further and further afield, really, because I've done so much locally. I'm currently working on a series of books on the England coast path, which are more like the Wales coast path, but that also includes a hand-drawn guide to the Yorkshire coast. All of these are in sort of more than halfway through, but waiting on the path actually opening up. So that's been keeping busy for the last couple of years and probably will for the next year or two. But I will come back to the Woods Part 3, Lower Calder Valley and Home and Cone Valleys. And I've sort of recently, I have to do that one first, but I thought about West Yorkshire miscellany for all the other bits that were missed out from the other books, because obviously I focused on woods and moors. But I went for a walk up Worley the other day, which I don't know particularly well, but Worley, there's no woods there particularly. it's below the moors. It says never fitted in any books, so I don't really know it. And I was like, it's a lovely, I had a really lovely walk. And I was like, yeah, I need to cover this. And also was orienteering on a Northern Moor the other day, yesterday. And again, it's a landscape that I haven't mapped, so I don't know as well. But I feel like there's a lot of areas that I missed out that would come in. So I'll come back to the Calder Valley to sort of fill in those gaps at some point. Because there's always something else, yeah.
Just quickly, because we haven't got much time, but what's your favourite valley in the Calder Valley? Do you have a favourite? I have a favourite.
Might be the same one.
Mine's the Calden. Calden Valley is
mine. Oh, okay. No. Yeah, Calden's lovely, but Crimsworth Dean is lovely. It's a shame there's not a few more paths in the valley bottom. And Lumhole is not the... Lum Falls is not this little gem anymore. It's kind of become an eyesore. But I would say Cragvale, I think, is the most special. I think I can be up there and think I'm in the Lake District here. It's just got everything, the woods leading up onto the moors. The river itself is just like lovely to walk, and I think it's pretty special.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Chris. It's been really fascinating.
Thanks, it's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to History Out Loud, a podcast by Calderdale Libraries. Produced and presented by Jill Carpenter. Join us next time for another transatlantic special, Buffalo Bill, Sharpshooters, the Wild West, and its connection to Halifax.